Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild. Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and today we are talking about the Karen Reed case. This is day four, I believe. Before we begin, I think it would be helpful to clearly outline exactly what Karen Reed is being charged with and what potential outcomes could look like. So Karen is being charged with three things. The first one is second-degree murder. This means she's accused of intentionally killing John O'Keefe without premeditation. If convicted, she could face life in prison. Number two, she's charged with manslaughter while operating under the influence. It's also abbreviated as OUI manslaughter. This charge alleges that she caused John O'Keefe's death by driving under the influence of alcohol. Number three, she's charged with leaving the scene of a collision causing death. This implies that she left the accident scene without stopping to call for help or assistance. So could the jury consider lesser charges? Yes, they can. If the jury isn't convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that she is guilty of the more serious charges, then they have the option to consider lesser offenses. So they could consider involuntary manslaughter, and this would suggest that she caused John O'Keefe's death through reckless or negligent actions without intending to kill him. They could also find her guilty of motor vehicle homicide instead, and this charge applies if someone causes a death while operating a vehicle negligently or recklessly. Now, these lesser charges carry lighter sentences, of course, but still represent serious felonies. For second-degree murder, it carries a possible sentence of life in prison with eligibility for parole after 15 years. For OUI manslaughter, the possible sentence is a minimum mandatory sentence of 5 years with a maximum sentence of up to 20 years. For the charge of leaving the scene of a collision causing death, the possible sentence is a minimum mandatory sentence of 1 year and up to 10 years in prison. For the lesser charges, involuntary manslaughter carries up to 20 years in prison, though sentencing can vary depending on the circumstances. And for motor vehicle homicide, it can range significantly depending on the circumstances, but she could be looking at a range from 2.5 years to up to 15 years if that is what the jury chooses. All right, with that out of the way, let's get into yesterday's testimony, which would have been Tuesday, April 29th. Ian Whiffen, a digital forensics expert from Cellebrite, was back on the stand, and the defense focused on challenging his previous testimony about the timing of a controversial Google search, which was made by Jennifer McCabe. Ian Whiffen testified that while the browser tab was opened at 2:27 a.m., the actual search was not executed until 6:24 a.m. Another big topic I wanted to include was that they discussed the flights climbed issue. So John O'Keefe's phone registered through the health data feature on the iPhone that John took multiple steps throughout the evening and even climbed 3 flights of stairs. Now, many people on Karen's side believe that these 3 flights climbed could be John inside the house at 34 Fairview, further bolstering their claim that whatever happened to John actually happened inside the house. But Ian Whiffen testified that iPhones register a change in altitude of at least 3 meters as a flight of stairs climbed. And when you take the timestamp of those flights and then correlate them with the route that Karen drove to get to the Alberts' house, the topography shows a change in altitude that correlates with those flights climbed. So Ian is testifying that he didn't actually climb any stairs, he just went uphill in Karen's car. Then Ian Whiffen testified to the phone's exact location, showing in a visual how the phone registered multiple locations from the driveway to the house, indicated by red dots on the screen. So he showed the court an aerial view of the Albert house, and then all over the front yard, there were red dots indicating locations of the phone throughout the night, except the dots aren't exact pinpoints. Rather, it's like a radius of that dot. And as time goes on, if the phone stays stationary, then the radius gets smaller and the accuracy improves as long as the phone isn't moving. So the sizes of the radius kind of vary, but what is important is that most of the dots are located in the yard by the flagpole where John was eventually found. But more importantly, and what the defense will have to counter, is the fact that the last activity on the phone occurred at 12:32 a.m. when the phone was locked for the final time. And although the radius does include parts of the Alberts' house, suggesting that he could have gone into the house at some point, there is never a dot placed inside the house. And you would think that if he had gone into the house, then it would at least register one dot within the house, right? But it didn't register any. However, the radius does overlap the house, suggesting that even though there's not a dot on the house, he still could have gone in because the radius includes the house. So, do with that information what you will. But furthermore, the phone registered temperatures on the battery. And from the time that he was dropped off by Karen to the time he was found in the front yard, the phone only registered declining temperatures, whereas Ian testified that he would expect to at least see a rise in the temperature if he went inside of a building at some point. But there wasn't. It was just kind of a steady decline. Now, if I'm a juror at this point, I'm kind of starting to believe that maybe John did not go inside the house, but it's still too early to see how the defense plans on overcoming this in the long run. And we still have a lot of trial left. I will, of course, mention the cross-examination because it kind of pulled me back in. You know, like I was kind of starting to feel for the prosecution and lean a little bit towards what they were saying, but then defense just reeled me right back in. So what I want to hear are your thoughts on this, which is, does Ian Whiffen's testimony make you doubt Karen's innocence at all? Let me know in the comments on Spotify, or if you're listening on Apple, you can leave comments on my IG or through my website, mamamystery.com, by just scrolling down to that box and sending me a quick message. So now let's get into how the defense questioned the reliability of Ian Whiffen's analysis and how they highlighted the lack of a validated hash value and potential issues with the chain of custody of Jen McCabe's phone. So let's elaborate a bit on that. First, I want to distinguish what exactly a validated hash value is and why it matters, because I did not know, so I had to look it up. But think of a hash value as a digital fingerprint or DNA for data. It's a long string of characters. It's a unique code generated from the contents of a file or data set. So if you change even a tiny detail in the data, its hash value will completely change. In forensic work, when investigators copy data from a phone, they compute a hash value for the original data and then again for the copy. Now, if both hash codes match, then the copy is an exact clone of the original. And this process validates that nothing was altered during extraction. It's like putting a tamper evidence seal on a jar. And if that seal's code doesn't match or if that seal is broken, then you know someone opened the jar and potentially added or removed something. So in plain terms, a validated hash value is proof that digital evidence hasn't been tampered with or corrupted. It's extremely important because digital data can be changed more easily than, say, a physical blood sample. The hash is essentially a unique ID for the data. And when forensic analysts say that they validated the hash, they mean we double-checked the data's fingerprint to make sure that it is authentic and unchanged. Well, in the trial, it came out that Ian Whiffen did not have a validated hash value for Jen McCabe's phone data, specifically for that Google search, Haas Long to Die in Cold. He admitted that he was unable to validate the hash value of the internet search on Jen McCabe's phone, and therefore he was unable to tell if the phone had been tampered with. In other words, he could not confirm the phone data was an exact unaltered copy of the original. And that is a huge deal. That's like saying, you know, we copied the security camera footage, but we never checked if someone edited it in between, right? And the defense, of course, pounced on this. Karen Reed's attorney, Robert Alessi, basically asked Ian, so you have an unsigned hash value and can't guarantee the data's authenticity, right? And Ian had to say yes. By highlighting the lack of a verified hash, the defense was suggesting to the jury that the phone data might not be trustworthy, which is honestly the whole foundation of their entire argument, right? That this was a shoddy investigation, that there's too much doubt to convict Karen. So essentially, the defense used this point to say, the prosecutors want you to believe this phone evidence, but even their own expert can't vouch that it's pristine. So how much confidence can we really have in it? And when you're talking about a jury that has to convict or find a verdict without a shadow of a doubt, then the defense is doing a pretty good job placing all these seeds of doubt. Furthermore, they did it with the chain of custody as well. So the chain of custody was essentially incomplete. And when the defense questioned the chain of custody of Jennifer McCabe's iPhone, basically they asked who had McCabe's phone, when, and how can we be sure no one tampered with it before the forensic analysis? And it turned out that Ian Whiffen didn't know the chain of custody for her phone. He wasn't personally tracking who handled it prior to his analysis. So during cross-exam, Alessi pressed him on this point, and he said something to the effect of, you don't know the chain of custody of her iPhone? And the expert had to agree. So this was another gotcha moment for the defense by establishing that the phone's handling wasn't fully accounted for, or at least not to the expert's knowledge. The defense implied that the phone data could have been compromised. And as an expert, you definitely have to take that into consideration when you are giving your professional opinion on the data you've been given. I mean, I think as an expert, you should include that in your opinion, you know, that your sample of whatever you're testing is completely untampered with and pristine. And if not, then you should include that in your opinion, because you can't be 100% sure if you don't know the answers to these other questions. And there is no claim that something definitely happened to the phone, but the defense does not need to prove tampering. They just need the jury to wonder about the possibility of it. By highlighting a sketchy chain of custody, they're effectively saying, for all we know, something on that phone could have changed. The evidence might not be as ironclad as the prosecution says or wants you to believe. So when the defense is questioning the hash in the chain of custody, they're basically attacking the reliability of the timeline evidence. Maybe that 6:23 a.m. explanation is not true, and we can't trust the digital proof that says it's true because proper procedures weren't followed. And they even pointed out that the primary forensic software, which is Cellebrite, somehow omitted the 2:27 a.m. timestamp in its report, whereas another tool, which was Magnet Forensics, still showed it. Now that suggests that something might have been overlooked or hidden in the analysis, and all these details feed the defense's narrative that the evidence against Karen Reed is suspect. After Ian Whiffen's testimony, they brought Jennifer McCabe to the stand in the afternoon. So just a little background. Jennifer McCabe is a friend of John O'Keefe's, and she testified as a key prosecution witness. She's also the sister-in-law of Brian Albert, who was the homeowner where John's body was found, which placed her at the center of the case. She's also the one who infamously Googled how long to die in cold. Jen McCabe, however, has always maintained that she only Googled that after they found John O'Keefe's body, saying she did it later at Karen Reed's insistence out of concern for how long John was in the cold. Now, with that cloud of controversy hanging over her, her testimony was highly anticipated, And her testimony in the first trial was so intense, and a lot of clips from that went viral on TikTok. You may have already seen them. But if not, I'll go ahead and play a clip. This is from her testimony during the first trial. And this time around, she's a little more reserved. So, and I think that that's done on purpose. But just listen to this clip from the first trial.
Ms. McCabe, the reason you deleted that 2:27 a.m. call is because you realized that if you were caught Googling how long it takes for a person to die in the cold 3.5 hours before John's body was found, that would incriminate you, wouldn't it?
Objection.
The objection sustained.
Did you delete that search because you knew that you would be implicated in John O'Keefe's death if that search was found on your phone?
Objection.
Could you answer that, please?
I did not delete that search. I never made that search at 2:23. I never would have left John O'Keefe out in the cold to die because he was my friend that I loved.
But he's not your family, is he?
Family and friends.
Objection.
Sustained.
In general, how long it takes for a human being to pass away because of exposure to extreme temperatures, right? If you wanted to know the answer to that, mm-hmm. What would you Google search? What phrase would you use?
I'm not sure. All I recall is what the defendant asked me to Google in the morning.
If you wanted to know, I'm asking a different question.
Mm-hmm.
If you personally wanted to know, how long does it take for a person to die of exposure due to extreme temperatures, what would you put in? What phrase would you use?
Objection.
Sustained.
Well, we don't have to guess at the phrase that you would use if you wanted to know something about dying of hypothermia, do we? Because you actually Googled searched it.
Objection.
Sustained. Ask that differently, please.
Did you, in fact, use a phrase to Google search how long it takes for someone to die of extreme temperatures?
I did in the morning at the request of your client.
Okay. And what phrase did you use?
I'm not sure.
Really?
Correct. I was...
After 2.5 years of this, you don't know the phrase that you used?
Objection, Your Honor.
There's so many lies and misconceptions on social media.
No question.
Oh, I apologize.
Okay.
Are you telling me you don't remember what Google search you put in?
Karen was screaming, my hands were shaking, and she was saying, Google hypothermia, how long does it take to die in the cold?
And what phrase did you put in your phone? I'm just asking you to say it.
Why don't you show me it?
You literally don't remember?
Again, she was screaming, Google hypothermia, how long does it take to die in the cold?
How about?
And I picked up my phone and I started Googling.
And you literally, to this day, right now, under oath, you're saying you don't remember that phrase that you used.
Objection.
I'll allow it.
Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that at her...
Do you remember it or do you not, Ms. McCabe? That's a simple question.
That morning, I don't remember specifically what I Googled, but I do know what you've put out to the social media.
How about this? Hoss long to die in cold. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it's been everywhere.
Why does that sound so familiar?
Because you've put it out in social media.
Well, I haven't put anything out in social media because I don't personally have social media.
I'm sorry, Turtle Boy did.
So if the world happens to know it,
mm-hmm.
That's not on me, is it?
I guess not.
Hoss long to die in cold is what you put in to the Google search, right?
If you say so.
Is there a reason that you don't want to admit to that?
Absolutely not.
It's a simple question, right?
No reason.
So say it. What Google search did you use?
Objection.
Sustained.
You were seeking, at some point, to Google how long to die in the cold, correct?
Correct.
And you made a mistake and mistakenly typed hoss long to die in cold, correct?
If you could show me it, I'd appreciate it.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And The Epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
So I guess that kind of gives you an idea of what it's like to have Jen McCabe on the stand, or at least how it was during the first trial. Now, yesterday, when she got on the stand, under gentle questioning from Special Prosecutor Hank Brennan, Jen walked the jury through the evening of January 28th, 2022, the night before John O'Keefe's death. In a straightforward, matter-of-fact way, she described a casual night out around 9 p.m. She was at the Waterfall Bar and Grill in Canton with her family. Later on, we already know John O'Keefe and Karen Reed show up and joined their group at the bar. Everyone was in good spirits. She said it was just a typical average night. After midnight, now the early morning hours of January 29th, the plan was to head to the after party or an after party at Brian and Nicole Albert's house on Fairview Road in Canton. Now, Jen McCabe testified that she left the bar just after midnight with her husband and they headed to the Albert's house, expecting John and Karen to meet them there shortly. At the house on Fairview Road, a small gathering was already underway. They were actually celebrating Brian Albert Jr.'s birthday. So this is Brian and Nicole Albert's son. This would be Jen McCabe's nephew. And some family and friends were there also. But Jen McCabe recalled a lighthearted atmosphere. People were laughing, playing music. At one point in the night, someone put on It's Raining Men, or the music video for it, as part of an inside joke. And we've kind of had that confirmed through her Google searches. It was part of that. And, you know, she said they were just having a normal late night get together. So Jen McCabe said that she kept an eye out for John and Karen as the night went on. And she testified that she peered out the front window several times looking for them. In doing so, she noticed a dark colored SUV out front that she believed was Karen Reed's black Lexus. This SUV seemed to change positions, and Jen said that she first saw it in front of the house's front door, then later near the yard's flagpole, and later still a bit further up from the flagpole. Now, these quick glances were noteworthy because they suggest that Karen's car was indeed at the house at some point that night. But Jen McCabe even tried to contact John, saying, you know, she texted him saying, "Here," and "Pull behind me," since her own car was there. But John, she said, never answered. Despite seeing what she thought was Karen's SUV outside, neither Karen nor John ever came into the house, according to Jen McCabe. Around 1:45 a.m., Jen McCabe decided to go home. She said that she left the Alberts' house at about 1:45 with her husband driving. And then there were two other party guests, which were Julie Nagel and Sarah Levinson, in the back seat. So Jen McCabe sat in the front passenger seat, and importantly, their route out took them past the flagpole area in the front yard, which was the very spot where John O'Keefe would later be found in the snow. So defense attorney Alan Jackson, of course, did the cross-examination, and these two, you can tell they just hate each other, because if Hank Brennan is gently questioning her, Alan Jackson is doing the exact opposite. But he really zeroed in on this particular fact during cross-examination, asking how Jen McCabe could drive right past John O'Keefe's eventual location without noticing that he was there. And Jen McCabe explained that as they drove by the yard, she was not looking out the front windshield. She was turned around, chatting with the women in the back seat, not paying attention to what was in the yard ahead. So you can imagine the defense raising an eyebrow at that, but it is plausible. I mean, it's dark, it's snowing, she wasn't looking, she's turned around talking to her friends. Like, I can see that as a very plausible scenario. But at that point, Jen McCabe went home, still assuming that John and Karen had just decided not to come in, or maybe had left earlier. Now, a few hours later, the situation flipped from casual to frantic, and McCabe testified that just before 5 a.m., she was awakened by a call from John O'Keefe's niece. On the other end of the line, she could hear Karen Reed screaming in the background, sounding hysterical. And this call made it clear that John never made it home. And now everyone is worried. So Jen McCabe quickly got on another call with Karen Reed directly. And in that call, she told Karen that she, as in Jen, had seen Karen's SUV outside the Albers house a few hours earlier that night. But Karen seemed confused and distraught. And according to Jen McCabe, Karen responded that she didn't even remember being at the Albers house that night. Jen then described a chilling moment when Karen became extremely upset and started repeatedly asking, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? And this is something that the prosecutor highlighted because it sounds as if Karen herself feared that she might have struck John O'Keefe with her car, and that would be proof of a consciousness of guilt. But Jen McCabe testified that Karen also mentioned that she had a cracked taillight on her Lexus during that call, and that broken taillight would soon become a key piece of physical evidence. But everything surrounding the taillight pieces is so sketch to me because I have a very strong opinion about these taillight pieces. You can literally see Karen back her car out of the garage the night that she goes looking for John after she realizes that he didn't come home. She backs up her car out of the garage and bumps into John's car, which was parked in the driveway. And you can literally see it. You can see the tires move on John's car, so you know she made contact with the car. It makes perfect sense to me that the collision is what cracked her taillight. And then when she goes and looks for John, she makes mention of her cracked taillight, but it's literally on surveillance of her backing into John's car. And then later, and we'll get into all the nitty-gritty about this because I'm sure Michael Proctor is going to have to take the stand. But at some point, Michael Proctor obtained Karen's SUV, and the whole chain of custody with that is very muddy also. But it wasn't until after Michael Proctor had obtained Karen's SUV that any taillight pieces were found in the yard. And for me, it's very hard for me to believe with common sense, just basic common sense, that backing into a person would create damage to the car, like a shattered taillight. All the pieces are strewn about in the yard, and yet there's no bruises on John O'Keefe, and all of his injuries are on the upper part of his body. Like, none of that makes sense. And we'll get into that. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here. But when it comes to the whole taillight being a key piece of physical evidence for the prosecution, I have so many red flags about that. I'm not buying it. But let's get back into Jen's testimony. Sorry, I kind of derailed for a second there. But realizing that something was wrong, Jen says that she sprang into action to help find John. And so she, Karen Reed, and then a friend, Carrie Roberts, who I believe was either the first or second person to take the stand during the retrial, all agreed to meet at John's house to go look for him. So they met up and piled into one car. Carrie Roberts drove, Jen McCabe sat in the front, and then Karen was in the back seat to search for John in the snowy early morning hours. Before they set off, McCabe noticed the damage to Karen's vehicle, and Karen showed them the broken taillight on her Lexus. And Carrie Roberts even pointed out a sharp piece of it sticking out, worried that someone might cut themselves on it. So Jen recalled that Karen was adamant that their first stop be the Albers house on Fairview Road, essentially retracing Karen's steps from the night before. And that makes sense. That was the last place that they knew John and Karen were together. So if John was missing, perhaps he was still there. So they drove to 34 Fairview Road, and by now it was early morning and a snowstorm was underway. You can even see that in the surveillance too. It's like straight lines of snow because it's a snowstorm. So Jen McCabe described the tense moment that they arrived at the house on Fairview. They pulled up near the Alberts house and she looked out towards the yard's flagpole, which was the area where she had seen the dark SUV hours earlier. Jen said she couldn't see anything at first because of the snowfall and the darkness, but as soon as they got closer and the headlights illuminated the area, Jen McCabe saw a shape in the snow and it was John. Carrie Roberts, who was the first one out of the car, was already frantically brushing snow off of John O'Keefe's face by the time that Jen McCabe realized what she was seeing. So after Jen testified about just her recollection of events that night, it was time for the defense to cross-examine her. So if McCabe's direct testimony was calm and factual, the cross was where things kind of got out of control, tense, and combative. Defense attorney Alan Jackson, again, who is also just known for his aggressive style, but you can tell that he, of all people, really gets under Jen McCabe's skin, began probing for weaknesses in Jen McCabe's story and her credibility. So one of the first areas that Alan Jackson pressed was the end-of-night scenario. He challenged Jen on how she could have driven away at 1:45 without seeing John unconscious in the snow outside. Essentially, he asked questions to suggest that John O'Keefe might have already been lying near the flagpole when Jen left the party. So why didn't she notice him then? Jen repeated her explanation that it was dark and she was turned around talking to friends in the car, not looking out the front as they passed the flagpole. But Jen stuck to her account. She insisted that she had no idea John was out there when she left. And the implication that the defense wanted to raise here is that either John was not there yet, meaning something happened later involving other people, or if he was there, then Jen McCabe's awareness or honesty could be in question. Either angle helps the defense's theory that Karen did not hit John, but rather others did. Now, Alan Jackson's main line of attack, however, was that notorious Google search. This was clearly the elephant in the room, and the defense did not shy away from it. He zeroed in on the timeline of McCabe's How Long to Die in Cold search, knowing that this could cast doubt on her and bolster the defense's cover-up theory. So in a pointed tone, Alan essentially asked her, isn't it true you Googled how long it takes to die in cold at 2:27 in the morning, long before John's body was found? And you could almost feel the courtroom hold its breath at that question. But Jen flatly denied that. She testified adamantly that no, she did not perform that search at 2:27 a.m. while John was missing. She maintained, as she has all along, that she did that Google search around 6 a.m. or after at the request of Karen Reed. Now, I realize at this point, with all of these recaps I've been doing, it seems like we have spent the most time talking about this Google search. And it has been the main topic during this trial, during all my recaps, because it's all they talk about yet. I mean, this trial is expected to last probably a few weeks at the least. So I'm sure more evidence will come into play. But right now, we're really honing in on that Google search. And Jackson did not let it go at Jen just insisting she didn't Google it till after six. He pointed out that Cellebrite's software originally showed 2:27 a.m. as the timestamp. And then that data point was quote unquote deleted or corrected in later analyses. And then in cross, the defense suggested something fishy. They noted that an independent forensic tool, which was a competitor to Cellebrite, still reflected the 2:27 a.m. timing, whereas Cellebrite's updated report no longer did. So the implication was that perhaps the authorities or Cellebrite fixed the data to exonerate Jen McCabe, which fits the defense's claim of a police cover-up. Now, this was a dramatic confrontation, essentially the defense insinuating a data manipulation conspiracy, but she continues to deny any wrongdoing, and the prosecution later gave context through their expert that the change in the report was due to deeper research into the data, not a cover-up. In fact, earlier in the day, Ian Whiffen had testified backing up Jen McCabe's timeline, saying that all of his analysis showed the Haas Long to Die in Cold search happened after 6 a.m., not at 2:27. But again, we have the hash validation and the chain of custody issues, all to plant seeds of doubt within the jury. Towards the end of the afternoon, Jen McCabe had been on the stand for about an hour and a half. They went ahead and excused her with the intent to bring her back the next day, which is today, the 30th. But they wanted to excuse the jury to address the whole ARCA situation. So let's talk about that. Now, this stemmed from an earlier issue about defense experts from a firm called ARCA, which is their accident reconstruction experts. I think I talked about this in our last episode, and there were some discovery violations that apparently occurred. So after the jurors exited, Prosecutor Brennan argued that the defense had repeatedly violated court rules by not sharing certain expert information, and he even asked the judge to limit or bar some of the defense's expert evidence. Well, the judge was clearly unhappy with the defense's handling of evidence sharing, and she noted that there had been repeated and what she believed to be deliberate violations of her orders on reciprocal discovery. However, she also recognized that punishing the defense too harshly could infringe on Karen's right to a fair trial and her right to fully defend herself. So her decision ultimately was that she would allow the defense's expert to testify despite the rule breaches, prioritizing the defendant's right to a fair trial. But she did not let the defense off the hook without a scolding. So I'm going to play you a clip from yesterday afternoon when she is addressing the defense.
Mr. Lacy, I only have one question for you. So would you stand, please? You're arguing this, right? This was your motion. So my question is, how do I reconcile the fact that 100 text messages were deleted by counsel, and we heard yesterday counsel's preferred method of dealing with Dr. Wolf was via Signal. How do we reconcile that with the Massachusetts Rules of Professional Conduct 1.15. I don't see how you reconcile that.
Should I go to the podium?
Right there, and I expect a short answer.
The short answer, Your Honor, is the rule that you're citing has absolutely no applicability to this proceeding for the... Can I finish my answer, Your Honor?
Right ahead.
Has no applicability. That rule is intended to be between an attorney and the client. The court has no jurisdiction to enforce that rule.
I agree. That's a different body. But I'm asking you how I reconcile that when I'm trying to figure this out. Mr. Lessie, you know what? You're going to win this, so why don't you just let me make my ruling? And Mr. Okay. Brennan, I understand completely the Commonwealth's argument, completely the ambush that has been set upon here. However, a defendant's right to a fair trial is paramount to everything. So I'm going to allow the ACCA witnesses to testify. I am going to allow what I expect to be a very robust cross-examination. And I'm going to allow them to testify to everything that they said up until yesterday. And I expect counsel to comply with all rulings and rules of the court and all rules of professional conduct. And no more nonsense. Let's just try this case. All right? That's it. I'll see you tomorrow.
So clearly, Judge Bev is not happy with the defense, but when is she ever happy with the defense or anyone really for that matter? She does definitely seem to favor the prosecution, which is why I think she made sure to put that, you know, there will be a robust cross-examination that she's going to allow. So I have a feeling that she's probably going to be pretty lenient with what she allows. Like, I just assume that the defense will probably have a lot of objections and she's probably not going to side with them on very many. That's just my prediction because of her tone and her clear distaste for the defense team. And just to put it in perspective, the 100 text messages that she's referring to, this is really overblown, in my opinion. I watched the entire voir dire discussion between Daniel Wolfe and Hank Brennan, and Hank Brennan really tried to make it seem like there was more to this story, that Daniel Wolfe and Alan Jackson were actually buddies and that they were colluding together to make sure that Karen would get off and that their accident reconstruction would prove Karen's innocence. You know, I think he was really trying to play it up to be something more than it was. When their communications happened after the first trial was already over. So we're talking over a year ago, these discussions were happening and they had text messages, but they did eventually get deleted. However, Daniel Wolfe is saying, you know, he didn't intentionally delete any text messages. He just doesn't have a habit of keeping conversations on his phone after a trial is already over. So he wasn't expecting any of this to come back into play. And even those communications initially with Alan Jackson were all about kind of what the job entails, what they do at ARCA, what his specialty is, and what he, you know, provides to clients. And he also made a point that if the Commonwealth ever would have wanted to use them to reconstruct the accident, it would have been the exact same process of discussion and all of that. So the prosecution and the judge is basically complaining that those messages weren't saved, the correspondence wasn't revealed to the court, but the defense and Daniel Wolfe are all saying it wasn't anything to disclose. Like, it's a little bit of small talk, like, hi, how's your family? They had two phone conversations, I think, that were 4 or 5 minutes long. And Daniel Wolfe even said that it was likely that if Alan Jackson called the office, he was met by a secretary, and then the secretary would have to connect Alan Jackson to Daniel Wolfe, and that if he wasn't available, that's like a 2 to 3 minute phone call. So without any kind of conversation or context happening. So anyway, all of these examples came out during the voir dire process, and I felt like Hank Brennan was really, really pushing Daniel Wolfe to break, but he just wouldn't, because he's like, you're making a mountain out of a molehill, essentially. But of course, the prosecution and the judge are like, oh, I'm extremely bothered by this, and there's probably something behind the scenes. Like, why don't you have that same energy for all these butt dials that were explained away, or for Brian Higgins destroying his phone on a military base and smashing up his SIM card so that nobody else could get into it? Why don't you have that same energy for Michael Proctor as the lead investigator, texting people, calling Karen Reed, see you next Tuesday, and telling his friends that he's searching for nudes on her phone but hasn't found any yet? And he's supposed to be a employee of the state as a state trooper. So anyway, it just seems kind of like a lot of favoritism is going on, and you'd have to just be completely blind or delusional not to see it. But all right, I think that's it for today. We are expected to hear more from Jen McCabe today, which is April 30th. So I will be back on the mic with updates as they come. If you have any questions or if you have seen anything that I have missed, it's impossible for me to really sit down and watch the full 8 hours all day, every day. So I try my best to like keep it on in the background while I'm working at the ice cream cone, but I'm also slinging ice cream, so I can't always be focused. But if there's something I'm missing that you want me to include, please, please let me know in the comments. You can message me on Instagram. You can message me through my website, which is really the most efficient way to get a hold of me is through the website, because I will see that no matter what. But I hope you all have a great rest of your Wednesday, and I will see you on the mic within a day or two with more updates from the Karen Reed retrial. Thank you so much for listening. Stay curious, stay vigilant. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things that people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Visit progressive.com to see what you can save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.